When we come back, we'll talk about underground tunnels in Brewster, New York, as well as more of Phil's thoughts on UFOs and where they may be coming from. Phil, let's talk a little bit about the underground tunnels in Brewster, New York. You went there. Tell me why.
Well, sure. It all started back in the 80s when I just picked up the New York Post, and there was an editorial in there. And people in the Brewster, New York area were writing the paper to find out what was all the military activity going on in that particular area. And one of the persons who wrote in said they believe, because they saw military vehicles going back into the hills where the underground tunnels are. And this was the first time that I ever heard of them. And of course, you know, at that time I was investigating a multitude of sightings in the Hudson Valley, and I had a backlog of so many people I had to talk to and so on. But it kept, you know, it was in my mind. And sooner or later, I did get out to, and I got out there, and I tried to research where these tunnels were, and no one really knew where they were. Went to the Brewster Historical Society. I spent so much time in the archives in Putnam County, and it seems that they were so lost in time, nobody really knew where the darn things were. Finally, after much exploration, I found a number of them. And we have to go back in time a little bit, because that part of New York, the Hudson Valley area, Putnam County, Dutchess County, was the shoreline of Proto-America. And what was to be Connecticut and forming the Atlantic Ocean, wasn't formed then, crashed into that area of New York and melted all this iron ore. One of the plates subducted below and melted all this iron, which was down deep within the Earth's crust, actually in the upper part of the mantle, and pushed it upward. And this resulted in heavy-duty deposits of iron ore in this area, and a particularly pure form of iron called magnetite. And this was mined in the 1800s, and it was a valued ore because it was so pure. It made a high-grade steel, so it was in great demand. So what happened is that in the 1800s, these miners found these underground passages and just worked in them and expanded them because they were already there.
Sure.
Who put these tunnels there originally is a mystery, because they're not only on the east side of the Hudson, they're on the west side of the Hudson, the towns of Ellenville and Pine Bush and so on, where there's enough mysteries over there to deal with. And so in the 1800s, they dug these tunnels more, and the fact is that even back in colonial days, these areas have legends to them of Indian spirits, ghosts.
In the tunnels?
In the tunnels and around the tunnels, demonic creatures, and so on. Now, one of the interesting things that's happening, one of the mines that they dug out was called the Tilly Foster Mine. And it's still called Tilly Foster today, even though the mine is flooded. So what happened from the research I did, it was mined for iron ore all the way up to by 1820. And then for some reason it stopped. And it stopped for a while because what I can find out is there were multiple disasters there where people were disappearing in the mine tunnels. So in 1824, a fellow by the name of Tilly Foster buys the mine. And his idea, of course, was to cash in on the ore rights and mine that thing and sell the iron ore and make an incredible amount of profit. But the thing is, according to the records, Mr. Foster never mined the iron ore out of there. And the reason is that After he bought the mine, he was walking out of his house, and he decided to walk down to the mine entrance on a nice night and nice clear night, and he went for a walk. Mm-hmm. And he goes to the mine entrance, and he feels wind coming out of the mine, and he sees a mist coming out of the mine. And he feels a wind, and he thinks he hears a voice chanting that's speaking in an unknown language. And out of the mine entrance, he sees this apparition. And he can tell that it was tall, it was white, it was looked like it was in flowing clothes. And he said it was speaking a language which he thought was Native American. Now, the apparition, as the apparition approaches him, all of this wind is increasing, and it's like a hurricane wind.
Right.
And he's saying that, you know, he's holding on to his clothes, and he's holding on like this. He's wondering what he's seeing. And then the apparition slowly disappears back into the mine. Now, later on, you have to remember, in 1820, the Native American influence up in that area was still pretty strong. There were still tribes, and there were still a lot of full-blooded Native Americans. And he actually was quite troubled about what he saw. So he went down to the local pub, and he just mentioned that he saw what he thought was a ghost. And a Native American who was there said that what you saw, he said, was the ghost of an Indian princess. And he said that the legend said very old, a long time ago, her and her family were buried where the mine was. And there's a curse, whoever would start disturbing that mine area. And so this is the reason why Mr. Foster bought the mine, but he never mined. He never exploited it for its mineral rights. So in 1840, he dies, and his wife sells the property. And his wife sells the property to a General Harvey, who decides, you know, he's gonna take out all this iron ore.
Sure.
And he starts buying up the local tunnels in the area where the mining's going on. And he buys another of two mines called the Theo McCullen Mine and combines them to make the Croton Magnetic Mine. Now, the mining conditions went on for years, and people died in those mines. And most of them were immigrant workers. And the stories about ghosts, about creatures being spotted in this area from the mine entrance, it was driving people away to work in these mines. But what happened then was quite bizarre. In 1895, 22 workers were trapped in a mine cave-in.
Oh, my.
And 12 of them died. Now, three of them, the bodies were never recovered. Shortly after that disaster, globes of light were seen around the mine entrance going up and down the road, reported since. There were no reports before that, since 1895. The local legend says that the lights are the ghosts of the miners. But these lights are still being seen today, and they're spook light. We've seen them a number of times out there. People have gone out there. I've been out there. I've seen the spook light. I photographed it. I photographed it in ultraviolet film. And people go out there, and they watch this spook light. It's sort of like a pier. Sometimes it's barely visible in the visible light spectrum, but in the UV area of the spectrum, it glows brilliantly. As you approach it, it moves away. It was also seen sometimes traveling down the road at great speed, passing cars. And today, of course, people aren't calling it the ghost of the miners. They're calling it UFOs.
That's right. That's interesting.
Now, in 1901, Well, the Tilly Foster mine, after that great disaster, it met its last days. The mine was closed down. And another problem took place. The mine started to flood. They couldn't figure out where the water was coming from. This place was cursed since they started. The mine started getting flooded. And they couldn't figure out where they drained even the nearby reservoir. But the mine still was getting flooded. Today, the mine, the Tilly Foster mine, is a big pit. And it's flooded, and it's 500 feet deep, and it's all filled with water. So it's like this almost enormous pit lake. In 1945, because it was so deep, it was used by the United States Navy for deep diving and testing deep diving equipment. Now, one of the problems is that when they were down there, the sailors, the divers, they claimed that they heard clanging sounds down there at the bottom of the pit where the mine was. Later on, as they continued their experiments down there, they started reporting images, apparitions, figures walking on the bottom, clanging onto the sides of the iron walls with picks and hammers. And when they came up and told their story, the Navy doctors thought they were suffering from some type of deep diving syndrome with the pressures down there and the mixture of gases that they were pumping into them. But the fact is that they used similar areas that were man-made that deep and almost that deep, and there were no so-called hallucinations. But I find it very strange from that report that these sailors underneath the water reported these apparitions of these miners working on the walls. So this is a lot of phenomena that's generated. But in 1901, another part named Brewster and Southeast, another mine, It was called the Theo McCullen Mine. It combined to form the Croton Magnetic Mine with General Harvey. In 1902, the mine ceased operation.
Phenomenal. Let's take some calls while we continue to chat. Tucson, Arizona, we go. Scott, west of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. Hi, Scott. You're up with us.
Hi, gentlemen. It's great to talk to you.
Sure.
I was so excited and intrigued by all this, I just got overwhelmed and said, I got a call.
Good. I'm glad you're here.
You partly have answered a question that has been bugging me for a while about residual hauntings and what is the trigger that would cause a haunting like that to play back, since it's not necessarily a spirit, but just a replay of something that's already occurred. And when you talked about the magnetic fields going negative, that was kind of the key to it for me. I just thought, you know, that seems to be something to do with that. Because I've also read that iron, a lot of these residual hauntings, famous hauntings that play back like that, tend to be around places where there is a lot of iron or magnetic influence, from what I've read anyway. So.
Yeah, these produce areas of magnetic anomalies, and if the conditions are right and you have these loops of negative magnetic anomalies, these are places where you're going to find paranormal phenomena. So, you know, what I'm saying to paranormal investigators is that, you know, listen to this sort of stuff. You know, use, you know, some of the information from the scientific world and, you know, and look for these anomalies for wherever you are in the country or the world to, you know, test the theory out. But I'm pretty convinced that these anomalies, these negative magnetic anomalies, are the hot spots for paranormal phenomena and not the increase in the magnetic field.
In your work, Interdimensional Universe, you indicate now that you believe UFOs and the paranormal have this dimensional side, as we talked about a little bit. Was that a change for you?
Oh, yeah, it was a great change for me. You know, when I started all this back in the 70s, I was looking for spaceships, nuts and bolts spaceships.
Absolutely.
Like everybody else. But, you know, over the years and researching and collecting all of this data, you know, you come to the conclusion, you know, that there's no simple answer to this. And my ideas and my theories, you know, have directed where my the facts and where the research has led me. That's where I've gone to. And it's not like I'm forming my own ideas, is that the research actually changed my ideas. I found out sometimes the exact opposite of what I believed or what others told me about areas of paranormal phenomena. But, yeah, I have changed considerably since that time. And I think it's about time that other people start changing, too, their ideas, because the multidimensional universe is so complex, is that we have to expand our consciousness more in order really to understand this. Otherwise, we're just going to keep on going around in circles.
That could explain why they merely disappear when people witness these things.
It explains why a lot of this phenomena disappears. For example, you know, I have to talk about, you know, creature sightings, like Sasquatch-like creatures.
Sure.
You know, here they are in an area and they disappear. They're not restricted to Washington State or British Columbia or parts of Alaska or the Himalaya Mountains. I live in Connecticut, and 10 miles up the road, there were Bigfoot sightings, and the creature disappeared. Doing research, going back to the 1800s, they had a creature called the Winstead Wildman. Before they called them Bigfoot and Sasquatch up here, they were calling them the Wildmen. They appear in an area, people see them, they're bona fide, verified sightings, and yet these creatures seem to just vanish. And where do they go? I mean, it's almost like somebody used the term once, window fallers. Like these dimensional windows open and these creatures fall in and they fall back out of our reality. So, you know, a lot of this is incredibly intriguing, but if we take into consideration the multiverse and the multidimensional universe, you know, we can take a better look at paranormal phenomena and begin to understand it more.
Are you saying, though, that almost everything paranormal is interdimensional?
I'm saying that everything paranormal means outside of normal.
Sure.
So I'm saying,
of course, that paranormal could be the normal.
Well, it could be.
The normal could be the paranormal. That's right.
Yeah, our existence could be the paranormal. But from our reality, from human point of view, things we don't see and perceive with our instruments or with our senses are outside of our reality. So, you know, we call it the paranormal because we don't understand it. I believe that what we're calling the paranormal now is going to be our science maybe of 22nd century. Surely back in the 17th and 18th century, even the 16th century, people saw things that they didn't understand back there, and they labeled it with supernatural causes. We're seeing things today. We understand a great variety of things that we didn't understand before, but now we continue to be exposed to more things that we don't understand, and we're once again giving it supernatural explanations because we don't know exactly how to label it, but we may understand it 50 years, 20 years from now, 100 years from now, and we may have this knowledge and this understanding of all of these extra dimensions around us, and that all this phenomena could generate that we don't understand because our instruments can't detect it and perceive it.
We'll talk about the contact phenomena when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Amazon.com is taking pre-orders of Bill Burns and my book, Journey to the Light, which comes out in a few months at bookstores. They've got a steep discount on it. This book is based on stories that you sent in to us about your ability to journey to the light and how that has basically changed your life. So it's out there on Amazon.com if you're interested. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Phil Imbrogno. And let's go back to the calls. Rochester, New York. Melina, you're on with us. Hey, Melina.
Hi, good morning.
Morning to you.
I have a question. How do the interdimensional communications relate to the fractal concept and theory? I've always found the fractal theory very fascinating.
Hmm. Bill, you with us?
I'm with you.
That's for you.
I'm not exactly sure what you mean.
the fractal concept in theory, where things get just never end into infinity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I really don't know how it relates, because this is like an open field for exploration. We only got bits and pieces of all of this EVP going on and picking up these voices from who knows where they're coming from. And I believe they're coming from a number of different sources. But, you know, there may be, you know, even bridges in time and space. I mean, we're beginning to learn now that, you know, the past, present, and future coexist together. And it may actually be picking up things that occurred in the past or that are in the future at a particular time. But reality is definitely more complex than we realize. And I think that would be... you can speculate, and to me, speculation is good because speculation leads to discovery. Some scientists would say that speculation has to be controlled, which is true. But a lot of wild ideas and a lot of theories and speculation is going to lead to discovery here, because it's going to gear people into particular areas. So I think we have to do a lot more work on this before we can actually put a 100% label on any of it.
And, you know, the fractal concept, of course, is like the same principle behind the hologram, which means basically that each part contains a copy of the whole. So, you know, there could be lots of planets, lots of universes just like ours, Phil.
Well, you know, that's the particular idea, that there are a number of different realities that exist, a countless number of realities in which things are very, very slightly different. And that these people in these other realities are doing the same thing that we're doing, and we're communicating with them. They think that we're spirits, and we think they're spirits or ghosts, and you just may be talking to another person in another physical reality. I mean,
it could be. Tell me a little bit about contact phenomena. What's going on in that area?
Well, contact phenomena is like, you know, it's like a runaway train. There's more people who are claiming contact with not only aliens, but all variety of different types of entities. And it seems to me almost like a grand show that sometimes, you know, these entities, whatever they are, maybe we're not dealing with a variety of them, a great number of them, is that an entity can take on a different shape and appear exactly like these people expect to see them. If you expect to see aliens, they're aliens for you. If you want to see angels, they're angels for you, and so on and so on. But the number of people that have, contacted me about these experiences has increased considerably. And you have to put them in the categories, because the contact phenomena varies considerably. And I'm beginning to believe that most close encounters in UFOs are actually forms of contact. And some of the contact is so subtle that ideas or is a connection is made that isn't reestablished for 20 years or so. And for example, and I base this on, for example, people who had close encounters in the Hudson Valley.
Yes.
Well, 20 years after their close encounter, now many of these people that I've kept in contact with are claiming, you know, a communication with an alien intelligence. Boy, bang, where does this come from? My gosh, you know, what's going on here? I talked to a psychologist about this, and you know, of course, an explanation from a psychological point of view is that people feel that the world is so troubled that they're using UFOs and the paranormal phenomena to escape reality. But I said to him, see, that doesn't make sense, because many of these people who got into this really weren't looking for it. And because of these contact experiences, their lives have changed, and some of them for the worse. And I said, why would you have a life that that's tolerable only to create a false reality that's put you in more psychological trauma? It's like, you know, being in the frying pan and jumping into the fire. Why would you do that? And of course, the explanation is, we don't know, you know, what's going on here. The fact is that many of these people, you know, they don't want this contact experience. but they can't stop it. And it's totally changing and controlling some people's lives.
Next up, we go to Marietta, California. Brian, it's your turn. Go ahead, Brian.
Good morning, gentlemen. Very good show this evening. I wanted to ask Phil if he was familiar with the work of Nikolai Korzerev, a Russian physicist, sort of the Russian Einstein, and the Korzerev mirrors, which are null magnetic devices that Korzerev experimented with for psychic phenomenon and things of that nature.
I've read something about it, yeah.
They're really incredible devices made of a substance called mu metal, and the devices look sort of like MRI machines. And Korzerev did most of his work in the 1930s and the 1940s and sort of pretty much was hidden work until the Iron Curtain came down. And I think a book was written called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain. And that
I'm familiar with that one.
Yeah, that's where his work was first exposed. The work continues, and apparently it's done as close to the North Pole as possible during the winter. And apparently in these null magnetic fields, he, with this Korzerev mirror, he's been able to eliminate a great deal of magnetic fields inside what Richard Hoagland would call a torsion field. So he was one of the originators of the torsion sort of energy concept. And all of this seems to align with what you've discovered here.
Yeah, and you know that's fascinating research, and now we can add another element to this is that over the past number of years, our sun has been very quiet.
Very quiet.
And you know, and I tell you, you know, I'm involved in the scientific circles. I do research and so on. I'm not only involved in education, but I do research. And the quiet sun is a great concern to solar physicists. And the thing is that since the sun is not generating, an intense solar wind, what's happening to the Earth's magnetic field? The Earth's magnetic field is starting to drop. So you're not getting all of these incredible active charged areas in the magnetic field. So once again, you see, because these negative magnetic anomalies have been at their highest point in the last 22 years. And we're seeing this drop in the magnetic field, and we're seeing an increase in paranormal phenomena. So that correlates some of this theory about, you know, the dimensional openings and these magnetic, negative magnetic loops. And so here we see that we have another cause, is that our star, you know, controls the intensity of the Earth's magnetic field and how it operates. And because the sun has been inactive, we've seen an increase in paranormal phenomena. And I believe, in 2012, the sun is going to be at its maximum and its solar max. And that's only a couple years away. I looked at the sun not too long ago, and it looks like a bland ball. And I've never seen it that before. I mean, you know, it's gearing up for something. And we're due for something going on here on a
typical solar minimum, 485 days. This one, almost 700 days.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's phenomenal. I mean, the sun is not as predictable and stable as we think it is.
We've had one sunspot in 47 days.
Yes, I know. And it was a very tiny one to begin with.
Yeah, just a quick one. What do you think the Mayans knew, Phil? You ever look at that, 2012?
Yeah, I did, and in my new book coming out March 2012, I touch upon that I think it was phenomenal of what they did. I mean, there's so many things happening in 2012. We have this activity with the sun. I mean, what's going to happen there? There's a number of possibilities that the sun is actually collapsing on itself right now. The core is building up in a T. And what's going to happen eventually is that all the activity that we should have seen as sunspots and solar flares during the solar maximum is building up, is going to release as one burst of energy. Boom. What happens to planet Earth? My gosh, we'd be in a lot of trouble. Also at that time, you know, this lining up with the galactic core, yes, it's going to happen. It's astronomically going to happen. We're going to line up exactly with the black hole in the center of the galaxy. Another thing that's happening is the planet Venus is going to cross the disk of the sun in 2012. And we're entering the end of the wobbling of the Earth, its precession going around in its orbit around the Sun. So there are a lot of these things happening exactly for 2012. How could this be more of a coincidence? I mean, how did the Mayans know that 2012 was going to be the beginning of an important year or a change for human beings? And I believe that if we're not dealing with doomsday, which I hope we're not, that after 2012, we're going to see a drastic change in the human condition, and we're going to see a drastic change in our perception of the dimensional universe. So things like interdimensional beings may be something common. UFOs may be common. Kids will come home from school and say, gee, Mom, you know, on the way home from school today, I saw this little creature running across the road. I mean, if you go back in time, it seems that these cycles have happened before, whereas people have reported bizarre creatures and entities, intelligent entities from gnomes to fairies or angels, whatever, you know, they wanted to be called, gremlins and so on. And these were like more than legends to these people. The people, it was a reality to them. It was part of their life, part of their existence. And then all of a sudden, you know, we have this dimensional rift cut off from us, and all of these phenomena and these creatures just disappearing and becoming part of our legend. And all of a sudden, you know, it's starting to increase again. And we may be heading to a point where, you know, this dimensional rift is going to occur again. And what the people in the Middle Ages and all the fears that they had of these creatures and so on, it may be part of our reality again. And we see this in the contact experience. More people are claiming contact with something that's obviously not human and receiving some type of messages or signals about from some type of non-human or alien intelligence. When I say alien, I don't necessarily mean from a star system. I mean, you know, outside an intelligence that's outside of our normal reality.
Okay, we've got next, Anonymous, east of the Rockies, out there in Florida. Go ahead there.
Yes, hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
It's nice to talk to you. It's nice to have someone to talk to about this. I've been experiencing escalating contacts. It started with what was a bump kind of a thing, and they seem to visit when they think I'm asleep, but I'm almost total insomniac, so I sometimes just lay there with my eyes closed, waiting for sleep to come, but they'll think I'm asleep. So they bump me, that's where it started. And then it moved to touching, and now it's gone even further. And my question is, how do you stop it?
How do you stop it? I really don't know. I don't know if we're in control of the situation. And what you said is typical of what I've heard over and over again in the last several years about these entities coming while you're sleeping. And I actually did a chapter on it in my new book coming out called Night Visitors, and it deals with the contact situation involving at night at particular hours. You know, I took all of these cases and I found out that, you know, they take place within a certain time period at night. And many of them are the same, and these entities come in. And some of them look like shadow people. Some of them look like the gray aliens. Some of them look like hideous monsters. And in many cases, they interact with the person in bed by touching them eventually, and the contacts seem to get more intense as time goes on. It seems that at first they're feeling you out, and then the contacts seem to become more intense and more involved. I've heard of people who just jumped out of bed and yelled at them and said, get away from me and don't bother me, and that seems to chase them away for a while. But the point is that which, you know, I'm still working on is why are certain people selected and why are people not selected? And if people are skeptical and they're listening to this, they could say, well, these people are mentally unstable. And the point is that there's no evidence of any psychosis in a lot of these people until they've had the contact experience. And, you know, and I work with a psychologist who deals with a lot of these cases with me. But it's a fascinating phenomenon. But how to stop it is I really don't know. I mean, people would say many different techniques about breaking off the contact, but I haven't found any real way to do it.
No, not at all. But Phil, you are doing a good job with research. How many other people are out there doing what you're doing?
Well, I don't think there's not too many. I was very pleased to learn, you know, through Rosemary that, you know, there are people who are working on the same idea in EVP, which I think is an important field to get into. It's a pioneering field. You know, we're at the very early stages of this that could erupt into a major breakthrough for the human race and in our exploration of the unseen universe. But there are very few researchers that are doing this with an open, objective mind. Most of them are locked into that they're either aliens or ghosts or something like that. And but I try to apply our current knowledge of science and technology to the study of the paranormal. And there is a connection there. And I usually use the example, and I don't like to compare, you know, Einstein, but, you know, when Einstein was alive, he looked for a unified theory to tie all the forces of the universe together, and he never could find it.
No, but he tried.
He tried, but, you know, talking about string theory now is now a unified theory of gravity. I think, you know, I'm basically trying to do the same thing. I'm looking for a unified force to tie all forms of paranormal phenomena together. And I think the answer is with the multiverse, the multidimensional universe, and looking beyond the fact that, you know, we just live in this physical universe, and what we can see with our instruments and our telescopes is the true reality. But I believe it's much more complex than that. There's an unseen universe around us that is not dumb. It's intelligent. And now it seems, for whatever reason, 2012, believe whatever you want to believe, dimensions are crossing together, that this unseen universe is coming closer to us and interacting with us. We're not discovering it. It's almost like appearing in front of us and say, look at these phenomena.
And it's here. Discovering us. We'll be back with Final Calls.